Lasson. So this afternoon we return to the meditative cultivation of empathetic joy. As you recall, there are kind of two whole domains of experience to which one can direct such a sense of rejoicing or satisfaction. One is on the fruits, and the other one's on the roots. And that is when we attend to other people's, their joys, their successes, their happiness, their triumphs, and so forth. That's the fruits. And of course, we can direct that inwardly as well. But then the roots, and that's what I'd like to focus on this afternoon, for ourselves and others, devoting ourselves to really cultivating the underlying causes, the real causes of human flourishing, genuine happiness, and so forth. So this week is drawing to an end, and I think for many of you this last week has been quite interesting. For many, quite a learning experience. By the time you get into the third week, you're probably over jet lag, you're probably getting in something of a rhythm, and then deeper habits, old tendencies, habitual formations, tend to become much more manifest. At the beginning, one is adjusting, getting used to the climate, and just the whole change, but now we're in the retreat. We're not beginning the retreat, we're not finishing the retreat, we're just right in it, you know? And then a lot of stuff comes up, so whatever the habitual, just the old habits are, now is the time they're going to be really cropping up, because there's just so few distractions, so few things that we can get our minds off our minds, and so we get to be with our minds a whole lot, and there we go. So it's very easy to, as we're evaluating our practice, and many of you, first thing you say when you come and meet with me, the week has been up and down, up and down. Of course it has. The sun sets, the sun rises. Up and down is kind of the way nature works. But those characterizations are generally what's happened to us. You applied yourself to practice, and then how did it go? How did it go? Not how did you go, how did it go? How did it happen to you? And then it's easy to take a lot of satisfaction when we have one of those really good sessions. I think you've all had them by now, where that was a really good day. The next day sucked, but that one day, that was a good day. You know, and it's like talking about the weather. It happens to us, you know. But if we go a bit more deep, a bit deeper, then, and this is what I like to focus on in the meditation this afternoon, just taking satisfaction in applying ourselves to the practice at all, you know. Tsongkhapa, the great Tibetan master from the 14th, 15th century, said the easiest way to, I'll put it in modern language, the easiest way to empower your practice, to vitalize your practice, to energize your practice, whatever the practice may be, stage regeneration, Dzogchen, Shamatha, Lamrim, whatever it may be, preliminary practices, but the greatest, the most effective way, and he said the easiest way to really empower your practice is to take delight in it, to take satisfaction in it. Not just taking satisfaction in the really good days, followed by a couple of days where the bottom falls out and you feel, what am I doing here? But rather taking satisfaction in your very motivation at all. That is, what were the motivations that brought you here? And frankly, I don't have any question. There's no question in my mind that the motivation for every single person here to come, for many of you, from quite a long distance, some still significant difference, a distance, was a really wholesome motivation. I think I've gotten to know you enough that I have great confidence in that. It was a really wholesome motivation, a meaningful motivation, you know? That already is something to take delight in. And then from session to session, just seeing how you're applying yourself, doing your best, and knowing that the mind has old habits, but that's what we're here to break, you know, break down old detrimental habits, cultivate some really good ones, and just taking some time out and taking satisfaction in that. This is noble. This is noble. To come to a place like this that is all set up simply so we can cultivate the causes of genuine happiness and overcome gradually our tendencies to mental afflictions. So as we venture into the meditation, where I'd like to start would be on yourself, and especially for the kind of practices we're doing here. There are many, many, so many different meaningful practices, such a tremendous array, just in Buddhism, let alone all the other contemplative traditions. But the Buddha himself in the Kalama Sutta, speaking to a group of skeptics, he said, you know, if you focus on the four immeasurables, loving kindness and so on, then just in doing that, your life is already meaningful. And then he said, you know, whether there's reincarnation or karma or not, either way, a life that's really oriented around the cultivation of the four immeasurables, that's a good life. That's something to take satisfaction in, to rejoice in, take delight in. And then how quickly does it go? How quickly do you feel deeply stirred by the meditations? To what extent do you really feel a profound longing and aspirations that others may find happiness and the causes of happiness, be free of suffering and the causes of suffering? We can't control that. If we can control it, we'd just be all experts the first day, you know? But to even want to cultivate loving kindness, to even want to cultivate deeper compassion, and to do our best to actually apply some pretty well time-tested methods to do that. From my perspective, and it is a Buddhist perspective, but certainly from my perspective, wholeheartedly, I say that's something to rejoice in. And if it goes quickly, it goes quickly. If it goes slowly, it goes slowly. If it goes in starts and fits, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, sometimes just seems conceptual, sometimes seems much more heartfelt. That's life. But even to apply ourselves, to be coming, you know, there's so many things we could do in Phuket. You know, this is a big holiday resort. We could be on the beach. We could be enjoying ourselves. We could be having fun, you know. And here we are, instead of having fun, we're cultivating something really meaningful. So let the empathetic joy, the delight, the rejoicing start at home. And so for the four immeasurables, I would say with utter confidence, these are intrinsically meaningful. Every moment spent, whether it goes slowly or quickly, however it goes, that's time well spent. When we consider what are the alternatives, what's more meaningful, how's a better way to spend some time than to actually cultivate these qualities of the heart, I think I would have a hard time finding something better. And then we come over to the cognitive side. And I've said this to a number of you individually, but now just all collectively. And that is, it's so easy to be cracking the whip, especially now we've just finished more or less the third week. And people can feel, the time is passing. We're almost halfway through and I should be doing better. I should probably be meditating more. I should be doing more hours. I think I should increase the sessions. I think I should, like you're, you know, some taskmaster cracking the whip. You should be doing this. You should be doing that. You're not living up to my expectations. What are you wasting your time here for? You're a big disappointment. No. Not so useful. But in the practice of shamatha itself, just from moment to moment, as you're practicing, and in those moments when you're lucid in any of the three methods, when you're there, you're present, you're relaxed, you're still, and you're attentive, in those moments you haven't lost your mind. In those moments you're sane. And you're making sanity a habit, which means you're cultivating sanity, and not just flat sanity, like, okay, you were insane and now you're sane. No. We're seeing sanity from here to Buddhahood. It's just one whole long trajectory of increasing sanity, of wholeness, of collectedness, of composure, of healthy mind, sublimely healthy mind. So to my mind, if you can take satisfaction in that, let alone how your meditation is going, how you're progressing, you know, is it going better, and all of that kind of thing, just from moment to moment, with no anticipation, no looking ahead, moment to moment, just take satisfaction. Right now, I'm saying, right now, I've not lost my mind. I've not lost my mind by it being abducted and carried away by distraction. And I've not lost my mind by it slipping down into a hole of dullness and laxity. Those are two ways. You can lose your mind inwards, where it sinks within and just goes dopey. Or you can lose your mind outwards, where it just gets scattered and fragmented. Or you can hold it together, and that's where the meaning of samadhi, holding it together, and just maintaining that, even if it's a few seconds at a time, 3 seconds well spent. And then we slip off for 5 seconds, okay, fine, back here. Now we're 3 seconds again. And so take satisfaction in your own practice from moment to moment. It's an elixir. It really is an elixir. And then as we extend outwards, and this will be the final point before we jump in, as we extend outwards, then what I would suggest is then just open your heart, expand the field of your heart, out to all those around you, like everybody in this room, but of course not stopping there, to everyone, from whatever background, belief system, and so forth, everyone who's devoting themselves deliberately and consciously to an ethical way of life, really seeking, and this is so universal, but seeking to avoid injury, principles of nonviolence, but as well as we can, body, speech, and mind. There are so many people really wishing to, you know, not bring harm to the world. And on the basis of that, also then, so many different ways, offering their goods, whether it's money, whether it's their services, whether it's companionship, whatever it may be, but so many people really applying, trying to offer the world their best, and attending to that. They are sowing the seeds of genuine happiness. And so attending to that, so there's Shila, there's ethics, and then we'll go to Samadhi, and then we'll go to wisdom. So I think that should fill up for 24 minutes quite fully. Okay, and I just want to ask a question before we jump in. I've had a little bit of feedback on this. I'd like to have this actually, at least for this session, be a straight hands-up vote, so it's going to be a majority rule. How many of you find helpful having these more or less 5 to 10 minutes after the chime sounds? How many of you find it helpful to just be able to linger there quietly in meditation, silently, and then just continue on your own trajectory? How many find that helpful? And as opposed to breaking it and going right to discussion. So how many really like to have that extra, those extra minutes behind? I will count, okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 22. Okay, I was hoping it would not be 18. But 22, the eyes have it by a margin. I think it's 55 to 45. So at least for today, we'll continue. On occasion, we might, depending on how many questions come up. And this final one, just to let you know, I know that I've been sometimes rambling, or at least going off on tangents and giving very elaborate responses. What I'd like to do for the afternoon after the session is one hand goes up, it's one question per hand. So it's not I have three questions or two questions, one question per hand. And since I have a sense that some of you may have some questions or just things you'd like to share, that have been building up that just have not had a chance, and there have been no messages or questions up on the bulletin board, that I will, this afternoon especially, actually seriously make a point of giving short responses. Okay? But, yeah, you don't believe me at all. Okay? You just watch. I would say actions speak louder than words, but that doesn't make any sense right now. So please find a comfortable position and we'll jump right in. As usual, let's begin by settling the body in its natural state, the respiration in its natural rhythm, and for a little while calm the mind with mindfulness of breathing. And now let's move into the more active cultivation of delight, of empathetic joy. And even if you do not generate some sense of great joy or bliss arising from this meditation, a sense of satisfaction is certainly in this direction. I invite you now to look back, to recall, what were your reasons? What was your motivation for taking out time from your busy lives to come here and spend these 8 weeks? And if you find your own motivation meaningful, take satisfaction, take delight in the nobility of your own aspirations. Reflect back on the past 3 weeks, if you will, to your diligence, your dedication to practice, your sincerity, and the time and effort you've put in. And if you find your dedication and your time has been meaningful, regardless of how successful, how much progress you've made, what you've put into the practice, then take satisfaction. Take delight in your own practice. What are your aspirations for the future? How would you love to see your practice unfold? With what benefits for yourself and for others? Take satisfaction. This is how a meaningful life unfolds, consciously and deliberately. And now direct your attention outwards, expanding the field of your concern, of your awareness, of what is really real for you. Let your attention roam at will, but alight upon, focus on, those individuals and communities who are really devoting themselves to a way of life that is essentially ethical, wholesome, in the sense of avoiding, doing their best to avoid harming others, harming the world, the natural world around them, being conscientious in this regard, caring. And those who are actively devoting their lives, or at least a portion of their lives, to offering their best to the world, whatever their goods, their talents, their abilities, their resources may be, attend to them closely. Especially with each out-breath, breathe out this satisfaction, a sense of gladness, of rejoicing. This very sense of satisfaction can be thoroughly imbued with, or saturated, by a sense of gratitude. Gratitude on behalf of all that lives. Attend closely to those who are devoting themselves to the inner qualities, to the inner resources that give rise to genuine happiness, specifically in this broad domain of samadhi, this cultivation of exceptional mental balance, opening the heart to loving kindness, compassion, and so on. these great explorers, these great discoveries of the inner depths of the human spirit. Take delight in each one, in this room and elsewhere, in the past and in the present. Finally, direct your attention to those who are devoting their lives to the cultivation of wisdom, to gaining direct insight into those very much, very fundamental aspects of reality, the knowing of which transforms, liberates, and awakens. Take delight in these great sages and those aspiring for such wisdom. Show us the way, illuminate the path to our own freedom. Release all appearances. Let your awareness rest. Let's bring this session to a close. Any questions, comments, or insights? And we'll start with if anybody would like to make a comment who has not spoken before, give you priority. Yes. Beth, welcome.
It's kind of daunting. A few days ago, you made reference to the collective karma.
Yes.
So I wondered if you could maybe elaborate on that a little bit, and also our own how our own personal processes contribute to that.
Sure. That is a vast topic, and I will actually give a short answer. There are some things that we do entirely, I mean, for all practical purposes, we do on our own. We just go out and do it, and then it's finished. And so that's individual karma. But even two people joining the same motivation, engaging in an act together, then it's already collective karma. And so it's not just two things that are slapped together, but there's a dynamic of their working together. You know, so it's almost like spider webs or some kind of a connection, a matrix that forms between the two. So the act in itself is something that's collective, two people or a nation or a civilization or even a planet, who knows. But whenever this takes place, then this is where there really is this kind of a resonance. That might be a good word, a resonance in terms of intention, activity, of behavior, of thought, of motivation between one person's mind and another person's mind. And when they're resonating, kind of almost like a frequency or a wavelength together, then there's something larger, there's something compounded that takes place. And that means imprints are being stored that are also being stored collectively, right? So in that way, collective action, that actions that are done by two or more people, the seeds are sown collectively, that is individually, yes, but also there's something of a dynamic, this interrelatedness, this pratitya-samutpada, dependent origination. So in the Buddhist worldview, when that collective karma comes to fruition, when it fully matures, it's very much like a seed then germinating, giving rise to its fruit, then the effects are also experienced collectively. So there's a vast literature in terms of the Buddha's own teachings, let alone the commentarial literature, and then a vast number of accounts, stories, anecdotes, whatever you want to call it, of collective karma being experienced, that is, the fruits being experienced, and then the Buddha himself saying, oh yes, these people collectively did this together, and now they're collectively experiencing the fruits of that. And it all balances out, that is, whether it's wholesome, whether it's unwholesome, there it is, it's what is true for one is true for the other. Okay, so there's collective karma here, for sure. Okay, and 36, 38 individual retreats taking place as well. So it's both. Okay, that's all. Anything else coming up? Yes. Massimo.
I'm wondering how, if in Buddhism there is a concept of free will, and how is it related to the non-self?
And is related to?
To non-self.
To nonsense?
Non-self.
Non-self.
Yes.
It's just when I promised to give a nice short answer, you ask a question like that. I think I'm not guilty, you know, if I give a longer answer. Actually, I've spoken on that in publicly, a lecture that I've given with a set of PowerPoints, and I've written quite an extensive chapter on that as well. So that will appear in my next book, my academic book, Meditations of a Buddhist Skeptic. So clearly it's a vast topic. And it's so important. I mean, the first thing is something interesting in terms of background, and that is if you look in traditional Buddhist literature, will you find emphasis on free will, free will, free will? And then the question, do we have it? You won't find it. Not in from recent Western academically trained Japanese scholars, Indian scholars, of course, yeah, because they're aware of European thought. But it's not one of the hot items that gets discussed a lot, as it has been in the West for a couple of millennia by now. And so maybe to start there, and this is something we can return to, because it's vast and has many, many aspects, and I could easily fill the next 45 minutes talking about that, and I think it could be 45 minutes well spent, but not today. The short response, if one asked, you know, classic Buddhist teacher, do we have free will? Well, the question would be, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? What do you mean? That is, do you mean, can we make decisions that are based upon wisdom, without the decisions being dominated by or co-opted, appropriated by mental afflictions? Now that would be kind of a free will that really makes sense, that really has meaning, value, tremendous value. If whatever comes up and we need to make a decision on a course of action, whatever situation may be, whether it's individual or a large collective group, if from situation to situation we can invariably make our decisions without influence by delusion, craving, and hostility, but rather make our decisions based upon, that is, guided by wisdom and motivated by compassion, that would be freedom. But now, having phrased the question and defined free will in that way, the answer is, of course, we don't have free will. An arhat has free will, a Buddha has free will, but we don't. But then it's not like we just don't have it at all. And so and when this is phrased in Buddhism, if we shift this over, we can simply say, instead of free will, we can say, are we free? The answer is no. That's why we practice Dharma. If we're free, we'd already be arhats. But we're not free. And why not be free? Because out of delusion, craving, and hostility, we keep on perpetuating our own misery as well as contributing to the misery of other people. That's not freedom. It's not sensible. It's not wise. There's nothing meaningful about it, right? So when the Buddha addressed these issues, it was in the broader context of determinism and indeterminism. And those were topics that were discussed by the Shramanas, the wandering ascetics, the philosophers, the truth seekers during his era. And he addressed both. And that is, for everything that happens to us, everything that we do, is this all predetermined? Predetermined by the great machine of reality, that it's just all the cogs and all the wheels are moving, and it's just inexorable cause and effect. And what I'm about to say right now, this is already determined. There's no freedom, there's no choice. It's just I'm saying exactly what I'm programmed to say by my past lives, genetics, blah, blah, blah. But it's just, so is that the case? Is the present simply determined by the past? He unequivocally refuted that. He said, no. It's not only not true, but it's very detrimental to believe that. Because if you believe that, then all inspiration, all aspiration for freedom vanishes. And also, all sense of moral responsibility vanishes. I'm not responsible for anything. If I go out and kill somebody today, what can I do? It was fate. You know, the actions, I couldn't help it. I just did what those great big pushy causes and effects behind me pushed me into doing. And so, don't blame me, just blame the past, you know? So on both accounts, it's a total loser. But then we have indeterminism. And that is, are the next words coming out of my mouth, are they just chaotic? Are they just coming for no reason whatsoever? Sometimes I might give you that impression, but not intentionally. So are we just dealing with chaos? You know, do things just happen for no reason whatsoever? You know, not only a person's words, but, you know, everything. Do things just happen for no reason? Is it basically boiling down to chaos? And just things just happen out of whimsy, out of just caprice. And the Buddha refuted that. He said, no, not true either. The evidence is not compelling. Whether or not you're aware of quantum mechanics and indeterminacy on the quantum level, that's not true. That is, it's not true. It's not true that this is just a topsy-turvy world where causality is just a freak. And moreover, if we believe that, once again, why would anybody develop any powerful resolve to achieve freedom when you know that what's coming is just going to be totally chaos? It'd be like, you know, investing your whole Dharma practice in a roulette wheel, you know, and let's see how I'm going to do today. Oh, I'm not going to do so well today, because it's just all so there. And again, moral responsibility. If my actions are just happening for no reason whatsoever, then if I go out and kill somebody, well, don't blame me. Those kind of things happen. What can you say? Nobody's to blame. It just happens, you know. So there it is. He's following some middle way here between determinacy and indeterminacy. And the emphasis in Buddhism, I think I'm going to wrap it up because it would be so easy to go along and I think actually say meaningful things for a long time. But I said this afternoon I'd really try to be concise. I have not addressed the second and extremely important issue, and that is the issue of self. If there is no independent self, no autonomous self that's really in charge of the mind and making and autonomously making decisions about the mind and our behavior and so forth, then if anybody has any degree of free will, if we are morally responsible, because that's where it really counts, are we morally responsible? Are we accountable for our behavior? Well, on some occasions, no. If somebody comes and slips some powerful psychedelic into our food tonight, which I doubt very much, should that happen, and we start just acting just crazy, then pretty much any courtroom, and the judge would say, "Oh, but you didn't choose to be intoxicated," and let's say, what is that? There's some kind of a plant that not only makes you hallucinate, but you don't even know you're hallucinating. It's very well known. It grows in India. Remember what it is? It's very well known. It's one of those really bad psychedelics because you don't know you're tripping. You're so totally caught up in a non-lucid trip. I'll get the name later because I've cited it many times. But should that happen, you know? Or if a person suffers severe brain damage, and this has happened too, that fellow that got the spike right through his head, a very, very, very famous case in the 19th century. Well, we're not really responsible. We didn't choose to get a spike through the head or have it, and so forth and so on. So now we deal with a gradient. There are cases if a person is schizophrenic, if a person is really psychotic, that person is not very responsible for his behavior. Didn't choose to become schizophrenic, so not very responsible. And then along the whole spectrum, from there to enlightenment, more and more, more responsible. The emphasis in Buddhism is on intention, and that is intention, will. Intention or will, this is the guiding principle. So, in every school of Buddhism, in every authentic way of understanding the Buddhist teachings, we are morally responsible, ethically responsible for our behavior. And how so? Because not because there's an independent self, but because there is a relative self. As much as there's a relative glass of water, you know? And so, here we are making decisions. The very first time that I met one-on-one with His Holiness Dalai Lama, this was one of the two big points he made for me, and that is the greater our understanding, and not just intellectual understanding, but the greater wisdom, understanding, insight we have, then the greater our moral responsibility. So with knowledge goes responsibility, and that was his point. So in conclusion, then, in Buddhism, the question is not so much, do we have free will, as like, do we have a bicycle, or do we have a large frontal cortex? But rather, to what extent are we free, and to what extent and in what ways might we become freer? So it's a very dynamic question. It's a dynamic challenge. And it's moreover not something just to evaluate and write a book about it. This is how free I am. What you write about is, this is how free I am today at 5:25. But how much freer could I be at 5:28? And how can I be in an ongoing way, be cultivating freedom in the sense of being able to make wise and compassionate decisions about everything that comes up and not have them be dominated by delusion, craving, or hostility. And the more free I am, then the greater freedom of will I have. And there's my responsibility, to be as free as I can from moment to moment. Okay? That's a short answer. Yeah. Yes, Roger, go for it. The microphone is coming.
When I'm dwelling in the space of the mind, and I begin to ask a few questions like...
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt because I don't understand. State of the mind, you mean simply dwelling in awareness?
The space of the mind.
When you're dwelling... what are you attending to when you're dwelling in the space of the mind?
Well, I'm asking questions. Is there... who's attending? Who's attending to this?
Are you doing a practice that I haven't taught or among the practices
that
I have taught?
No, I thought you mentioned asking questions.
Just for framing, so that our communication is really clear. I know many of you are doing practices here in this retreat that I've not taught, and it's perfectly fine. Oh. It's very nice when you tell me what they are, so I know what other kind of ingredients you're putting into the pot. So this is not at all the case, you know, when you're here, you just practice what I teach. I never say that. Yeah. But for the practice you're referring to now, then I'm assuming that you're practicing awareness of awareness.
Well, it's more like you said... I started with the space of the mind, and then I went to awareness. But in my experience of the space of the mind, suddenly I remembered that you're supposed to then release. So now I'm in a dual situation where I have to think about exhaling and releasing. What am I exhaling and releasing? And I lost the concept of dwelling in the space of the mind. So
yeah.
I said, well, I'll just forget about exhaling anything, and I'm just going to breathe and maintain this awareness in this space.
I'm finding some blending here, kind of okay. a blurriness or confusion that is fusing things together.
Okay.
And I'm going to try to bring in some tweezers and Good. Pull them apart.
Okay.
And I do this simply out of my respect and real devotion, frankly, for the practices that I've been passing on. None of them did I create, and that's why I have devotion for them in part. So in the practice of settling the mind in this natural state, in that final phase, I introduced a highlight, an emphasis that I wasn't taught, that is, I wasn't taught do this emphasis, but I found that emphasizing this does help to make the practice fuller and complete. And that is, in the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, it's important that we're in an ongoing flow of knowing, right? Well, as we're attending to the space of the mind and its contents, there are not always events arising, thoughts, images, and so forth. So when there are no events, when you're looking and you're not seeing anything happening, then if you don't know what to look for, then you'll just be sitting there waiting with a blank mind, and that flow of cognition, that flow of knowing will be broken. So because that's a tendency, and very often people say when I practice settling the mind, as soon as I observe something, it vanishes, well, then what do you look at? So this is a very practical response to feedback I've had from people actually doing the practice. And that is, learn how to attend to and ascertain the space of the mind. You're not just resting in the space of the mind, you're ascertaining the space of the mind. Okay? So this isn't the settling the mind practice, but it's just one facet of it. When you're engaging in the full practice of settling the mind in its natural state, then you're attending to the space of the mind and whatever arises within it. When there's nothing arising within it, you're simply attending the space of the mind. But right there, vigilant, in the present moment, such that the next time that some distinct mental event arises, you ascertain it very quickly. Now, just resting there, attending to that, you're not asking questions. There aren't any questions in settling the mind in its natural state. Not once.
Okay.
No questions. Okay. It is simply a stabilizing, a placing. And as I mentioned to somebody today in a meeting, and it's just, I think, a lovely point, and that is, when we're doing that practice, we are seeking, doing our best to observe the space of the mind and whatever comes up within it from the perspective of the substrate consciousness. Now, what that most poignantly means here is that one of the salient qualities of the substrate consciousness is luminosity. And so we're simply brilliantly illuminating that space of the mind. So whatever comes up, it vividly appears. We know it. And the other aspect that I want to highlight here of the substrate consciousness is that it's non-conceptual. It's not thinking about, getting caught up in cognitive fusion of thinking about what's arising in the space of the mind. It's just quietly but discerningly observing and knowing what's arising there. So it's a type of knowing that we're really not taught how to cultivate in ordinary education system. And that's East and West now. That is, ordinary education system has a lot of pluses, a lot of advantages. I don't mean at all to just put it down. It's just that it's not doing everything any more than traditional Tibetan education does everything. They don't. But here's a mode of knowing that we don't learn in school, and that is how to be silently, attentively observing something without getting caught up in cogitating about it, projecting upon it, superimposing upon it, but just being present and allow, through that silence, a more intuitive, non-verbal, non-conceptual type of knowing to manifest and make itself known. So that's the nature of the settling the mind, but it doesn't entail any inversion like that. Then we come to awareness of awareness. So bear in mind that settling the mind, that's a complete and sufficient practice to achieve shamatha. And some people prefer awareness of awareness, or they like to do both. Now we're in another practice, another text, another tradition. Adjacent, very complementary, but not the same. It's very important not to blend them. In this practice, of course, there are different approaches to it, but the one I've been emphasizing is Padmasambhava, where in a certain phase of this practice, there is this release of the awareness into non-objectivity, a withdrawal back into just the awareness, a withdrawal from all appearances, back into just the nature of awareness, release. And as I've said quite a number of times by now, only in the initial phases and only if it's helpful do I suggest that the rhythm of the release and the withdrawal be conjoined with the breath. Padmasambhava never taught that. I've taught it once again because I've taught it for many, many years, and some people find it helpful, and hopefully everybody outgrows it because the mind becomes then so single-pointed and you develop your own rhythm that the breath is no longer the rhythm you want, and say, good, that was just trainer wheels anyway, just a temporary facilitator, then release any attention given to the breath. And maybe it's 20 seconds out, 20 seconds in, whatever you like. But now it's just this release out, release in. And then in this particular phase, then we do kind of encroach into Vipassana territory in the sense of asking questions. And the questions there are posed, the first of all, is what is the very nature of consciousness that is being released and withdrawn? Mm-hmm. What's the referent of that word? What's the referent of the word consciousness? And then not cogitating about it, just going right into the immediate experience. And then we take a step further in, which we did this morning, and that is as we're releasing and withdrawing, what is the very nature, what's the experience of being that person or being aware of that mind which is doing this, being aware of agency, so this relates directly to Massimo's question about who's doing it and do we have freedom. And then tomorrow morning we'll go even to a subtler level, and that is we're not always acting. We're not always doing things, right? When you're just sitting, being aware of awareness. Well, there's not much doing in that. You're just being aware of being aware. So it's be, not do, mm-hmm. right? So prior to doing, there's already a being. And so just being an observer. Being an observer is not an activity. It's not a doing, because your awareness can't help but observing. And so then, tomorrow morning, then we'll go into just being aware of what is your experience of being the observer? And that's more fundamental, more primitive, more deeper than I am acting, I'm doing this and that and the other thing. So if you parse these out, make them very clear distinctions, everything falls into place. Having said that, now you have more to say.
No, I see my error now is that I was a little bit bored with everything just being kind of blank, so I brought up some questions, but I understand the difference in the practices. Mm-hmm. Okay. Great, thank you.
You're very welcome, and I'll give you the one-liner on boredom. And that is, the greater the luminosity of your awareness, the greater vividness, clarity. The greater the vividness, clarity of your awareness, it's inversely related to boredom. I think that's almost mathematical, you know? And so, if you can be, and even the space of the mind, as you're attending to, I will elaborate just a bit, tiny bit, and that is, even when you're just attending to the space of the mind, you're not seeing anything come up. As you increase the wattage, you know, just increase the luminosity. There's nothing boring about that space. Because as you increase the vividness, you're going to start seeing little burblings, little bubblings. As one person mentioned today in a one-on-one meeting, as you're attending to that space, you may sense, and this has been, people have noted this for centuries, Tsongkhapa refers to this in the 15th century, as you're attending to the space of the mind, you may on occasion sense kind of a surge, a swelling, an uprising of something that is almost like an embryonic thought, an embryonic, it hasn't articulated itself, it hasn't fully formed, just some kind of a swelling, and then as you're attending to it, sometimes it never breaks the surface, it swells, and then it just dissipates right back in again, right? So this isn't boring, but it does get boring. Everything gets boring insofar as we lose clarity. And that's what enables us to fall asleep. Okay?
Thank you.
Good. Anything else coming up? Oh, yes. Ani.
In the practice of awareness,
yes.
Is there a difference in how you release the thoughts that might come up during that practice as opposed to mindfulness of breathing?
You know, there really isn't. It's the same. The only difference there is that when you're practicing awareness of awareness, you're so close to the nucleus of awareness. You know, you're just not going out to anything at all. And so you're so close that your chances, if you're right there in the moment, your chances of detecting the emergence of a thought, memory, image, and so forth really quickly are enhanced, right? Because you really don't have anything else to do. You're right there. So it'd be like sitting in the midst of a small, quiet room and having somebody walk in the door. Well, as soon as they walk in, say, what are you doing here? You know, buzz off, this is my room. You know, like a hotel room. Somebody just barged into your hotel room. Hey, this is my room. Get out. You know, gone. Whereas when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you're actually attending to something else. that is not your mind, not your thoughts, is not even the domain of thoughts. It's in the tactile domain until you get to the acquired sign, and even then you're attending to something else, the acquired sign. So it's almost like you have to notice the thoughts too. Like, oh, you came in, did you? Right? But the response is the same, and that is, it's simply one, if you like to not wear yourself out, it's one of just noting it and then just releasing it. First relaxation, and then releasing it. Besides that, very similar. Yeah.
Good.
But there are a lot of questions. Somebody said, I have so many questions. And now the person is totally silent. Linda.
Not really a question, just a sharing.
Please.
I shared with you this morning about after we did the Tonglen exercise. I have a not very useful habit of mind of holding on to things that are a little bit too long and mm-hmm. not releasing them mm-hmm. As quickly as might be more useful. And so after that evening, I was very ill. Mm-hmm. And you shared with me a different way to do the practice slightly rather than taking everything into the white light of the heart. I wondered if you might share it with the others in case it's helpful to anyone or even anyone listening to the podcast.
Sure, thank you. You're expanding your awareness to all those around you. It's lovely. This is an old issue. It goes back centuries and centuries because this Tonglen practice has been practiced at least 1,000 years, more like 1,200 and quite possibly longer. But especially when one imagines taking in not only other suffering, and that's when we consider the enormity of the world, just other suffering is a large enough item. But the practice is more than that. It's also imagining, symbolically, taking in the causes of suffering, other people's malice, their greed, their hatred, and so forth and so on. So that's a very, very toxic, very toxic. Can be even have a really ambience of malevolence about it, because malevolence is a cause of suffering. And so when imagines taking this in, it's happened for centuries, that if one takes this in and allows it to kind of get lodged, then it can once again give rise to a lot of problems, physical problems, psychological problems, energy, prana problems, and so forth. Because this little body mind of ours wasn't designed to take on that kind of a load, you know? And so various skillful means have been applied to, on the one hand, seeing the value of doing this, that what it really entails is an expansion of one's own heart, and a sense of taking really responsibility, deeply caring about suffering and causes of suffering of others, even throughout the whole world. So in principle, it's certainly very meaningful. But if it winds up debilitating or simply making us ill, then that's not so useful. And so the classic instructions there are, as you imagine bringing it in, then imagine drawing it into this just basically an infinite source of light, a fathomless, inexhaustible, there's the word, inexhaustible source of light at the heart. They can basically take it all and consume it without trace. So that's the idea. But on the other hand, if it doesn't work, I mean, there's all kinds of really classic instructions, but if we can't do them, then we have to go to plan B. And so if we find that it does just start giving rise to a heaviness, a darkness in the heart because we're not able to just release it, then better to imagine as we're breathing in, and again, it doesn't have to be done in conjunction with the breathing. That is a classic technique. I didn't invent that one. But it doesn't have to be. The Tonglen can be just at your own leisure, breathing, just going out, going in. But as you come in, imagine drawing it in. But rather than having it all come in upon your heart, in within your body, imagine simply drawing it in. And then like, as if, I didn't use this analogy, but I like it. And that is, imagine that more like just you're like sunshine. You're just like the sunshine. And as it even comes in towards you, like this dark mist, it just evaporates. So it doesn't congeal, doesn't conglomerate into some kind of dense, malevolent orb in your heart. But just because of the radiance of your own, the light of your own pristine awareness, as it even comes in, it just fades out and dissolves into empty space. Then that problem won't arise. Yeah. So that's a very practical question. Thank you. Yes, Andreas.
I have a question. You used the term sealing the path repeatedly. To seal the path.
To seal the path.
To seal the path, yes.
Okay, yeah. I think I know what you're referring to.
And what is the difference between this and stream entry?
Aha. I'm not sure that I've seen the term, the Tibetan equivalent of sealing the path. It's a little phrase I've coined, I think, but based upon classic sources. So we're dealing with two maps here, with two maps. So in the Pali Canon, then you reach the marga, you reach the path only with stream entry. Until then, you are called an ordinary being. Ordinary being. There's nothing irreversible that you've achieved. Until stream entry, there's nothing irreversible. So you may accumulate great merit and have tremendous benefits coming from that as the karma comes to fruition. You may become a chakravartin, a great king. You may become, you know, all kinds of wonderful things can happen. But the karma manifests, it comes to fruition, then it's finished. And then you go into the next life. And so basically there's samsara, up and down, up and down. That's what people in samsara have been saying since the beginning of nisara. How is your samsara? Up and down. That's what samsara is, up and down. Right? And so in the teachings of the Buddha, as recorded in the Pali Canon, there's actually irreversible directionality. There's a real vector out of cycle mode, only with stream entry. And although there are different interpretations of exactly what is necessary to achieve that, and I won't go into complexities of that, there are some different interpretations within the same ballpark, so it's very well-informed, meaningful debate. But there's no debate, and that is within this map, once you achieve stream entry, you've now achieved something irreversible. And if one really is embracing a Buddhist worldview, that is an absolutely enormous statement, a cosmic statement, a universal statement, that now you are on a path, a stream entry. It's as if you've fallen into a river with a very strong current, and the ocean is only 1 mile away. Or let's say it's even a quarter of a mile away. But this means that whether you swim upstream, whether you swim sideways, or whether you swim downstream, you will get to the ocean. And just imagine the current is so strong, it kind of doesn't matter what you do. You can go faster or you can go slower, but you will get to the ocean, period. And that's the nature of stream entry. So in the classic Theravada interpretation of the Pali Canon, it said once you've achieved stream entry, within 9 lifetimes, you will become an arhat. So you might achieve it in that same lifetime, maybe the next lifetime, maybe 7 lifetimes, but not longer than 9. So even if you're just goofing off, you know, it's hard to imagine a stream enterer totally goofing off, but, you know, among stream enterers, if you were more of the goof-off kind of stream enterer, you'd still achieve liberation within 9 lifetimes. You can't help it. I'm going to give one anecdote. I think it's a very meaningful one. I know I'm going to tangent, but I think it's meaningful. My primary Theravada teacher was, and I was just fortunate. I don't know what to say. I was simply fortunate to be able to come into his sphere of influence, because he was truly one of the great teachers. By general, everybody knew. His name was Balagoda Ananda Maitreya. He was renowned throughout all of Sri Lanka, one of the great teachers of the whole country. He lived, I don't know exactly how long, but I think 102, lived a very long life. And I had the tremendous good fortune, and when I was a monk in Sri Lanka and needing some guidance, somebody said, why don't you seek him out? So I did, and he was retired. If I had seen him 10 years earlier, I couldn't have gotten within, you know, close to him at all. He would have had 1,000 disciples around him. But he's retired. He withdrew to his little monastery in the village where he grew up, Udumula it was called. And he only had like a dozen or even less monks around him. And I showed up really like a stray dog. I mean, I had all the dignity and the bearing and the glamour of a stray dog. And he just took me in and fed me much better than scraps. Why I mention all of this? But that is my source. And from Theravada, he was really, I consider, my primary teacher. And wonderful, absolutely wonderful man. When the Dalai Lama came down to India in 1957 for the Buddha Jayanti, the celebration 2,500 years after the Buddha's enlightenment, it was my teacher who greeted the Dalai Lama when he arrived in India. So that was a nice karmic connection as well. Why I mention him? His name is Ananda Maitreya, for a very good reason. It's not a coincidence. Ananda, of course, was the attendant of the Buddha for something like the last 25 years or so of his teaching. And then Maitreya, the next Buddha, the fifth Buddha in this particular cycle of Buddhas. Well, my teacher, and I knew him when he was about 80, so 1980, 81, my teacher, I think early on, I don't know exactly when this aspiration arose, but he had a very profound, I mean, an absolutely core aspiration. His prayer, his prayers of dedication as a Theravada monk, he's 100% Theravada monk, and very non-sectarian, open, spacious, he could read Sanskrit, and tremendous, big mind, great scholar as well as contemplative. But his aspiration was, and he told me this, was his commitment, not just aspiration, but his commitment, his resolve, was he was devoting himself to the practice of Dharma with the aspiration of becoming Maitreya's personal attendant. He wanted to be the Ananda for Maitreya. That was his prayer. Well, about 40 years before I knew him, he had been practicing Vipassana, and his teacher told him that his practice was going very, very well, and that if he continued right on the trajectory that he was following, he would soon become stream emperor. Which means that within 9 lifetimes, he'd become an arhat, and in the Theravada understanding, you're not going to be reborn again. You're finished. You're finished with samsara forever. And so he looked at the prospect of that, that Maitreya, according to traditional prophecies, it's Maitreya coming as a fully enlightened being with all the, you know, the major and minor marks and doing everything that the Buddha Shakyamuni did, that's not happening for a very, very long time. Long, long time. And he figured his nine lifetimes would be up long before Maitreya ever showed up. So he stopped practicing Vipassana. He much preferred, he had a deeper resolve, aspiration, to become, you know, to express his devotion to the Buddha, and specifically to the next one. He stopped practicing Vipassana. He went off to India, learned pranayama, did this, did that, but he didn't want to become a stream enter, right? Because then he would have to become an arhat before Maitreya could ever show up. So there's that. And then you have, you know, once returner, non-returner, and then you're finished. You're an arhat. Now, that's on the in the Buddhist understanding based upon the Pali literature. When we come over to the Sanskrit-based literature, then we see other maps being used. Right? As there is something of a difference of map between the Theravada map of achieving shamatha and the Sanskrit-based Indo-Tibetan map, they're not at all incompatible, but they're not simply the same either. Although the descriptions of achieving shamatha are very, very similar. So the point here is, in the Sanskrit-based literature, which is now embraced in Mahayana traditions, especially Tibet, because they, more than any other culture, I think, really just embraced Indian Buddhism, and they made it their own in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, but even more than China, and China did an awful lot. Well, in this current, now we speak of 5 paths, 5 sequential paths. So the other one was 4 stages, starting with stream enterer, and it starts when you become an arya. An arya is a person who's had a direct realization of nirvana. And that defines you. When you've had a direct, unmediated, non-conceptual realization of nirvana, you're an arya. And you're a stream enterer, at least, right? Well, in the Sanskrit-based literature, again, for those following this tradition, they attribute this to the Buddha as well. They say, well, we can look at 2 paths prior to becoming stream enterer. Path of accumulation, path of preparation, and then once you've achieved those, then the path of seeing, that's, if you're following the Shravahyana path to becoming an arhat, this achievement of the path of seeing is when you achieve stream entry. And then there's the path of meditation, where you go beyond stream entry to once returner, non-returner. Then you come to the culmination of the path of meditation, and you achieve the path of no more training, and that's when you become an arhat. Okay? So then you say, oh, well, this shows preschool. This shows preschool, right? You're not just starting with the marga wing being up, way up there at stream entry, but you're saying, okay, well, how do you get to marga? What are the on-ramps? How do you get up there? What's the approach to become stream enterer? Well, that's what we have of the path of accumulation, path of preparation for. And so there are these 5 paths. The map is laid out in that way for becoming a Shravaka Arhat, for becoming a Pratyeka Buddha, and there are many, many references to Pratyeka Buddha, or they're called Pateka, I think it's Pateka Buddha, in the Pali Canon, but it's Pratyeka Buddha in Sanskrit. It's a higher level of realization, takes longer, but there are 5 paths if you want to become a Pratyeka Buddha. It starts with the path of accumulation, goes right on through the 5, but it's a somewhat different path because the culmination is a loftier and deeper state of realization than that of a Shravaka. And there's universal agreement in all schools of Buddhism on that. And then in Mahayana, on the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva path, once again, path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more training, but now it's a bodhisattva path. And so when you quoted me correctly as referring to sealing the path, this is what I'm referring to. Okay, and I'll confine it to Mahayana, but it's actually relevant to the Mahayana understanding of the Shravakayana as well. But let's just go to the Mahayana, because that's where the big focus is, of course, in the Mahayana tradition. And that is, you achieve the Mahayana path of accumulation. So it's a marga. It's a marga. It's not the Arya marga. It's not the marga of a person who's gained direct realization of Nirvana, but it's a path. Now we can speak of a path that starts here and the end is Buddhahood, rather than simply virtue here, virtue there, it flowers and then it's gone, right? And so there's this Mahayana path of accumulation. As there's a Pratyeka Buddha path, a Shravaka path, there's a Mahayana or Bodhisattva path of accumulation. And you enter that path, which is it's a pre-Arya path. You're not yet an Arya, but you've entered a path. You achieve that, you realize that, you enter that path when your experience of bodhicitta, the bodhisattva's aspiration to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, based upon very deep four immeasurables, great compassion, great loving kindness, when this motivation virtually becomes your mind, it becomes so rooted in your very being, that it's your core motivation. It's your prime directive. Anybody who knows the context, cool. If you don't, it's no problem. But it's your fundamental, it's your North Star. It's your fundamental orientation. It's your desire of desires. It is the most important thing in this and all future lives. May I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. When that motivation arises out of profound compassion, loving kindness, and so forth, and it not only arises because you've been cultivating it, meditating on it, and so forth, but it becomes so deep, the cultivation is so deep, that then it just it has its own resonance and arises just spontaneously. And so it's just what you wake up with. The Dalai Lama was asked, you know, what's your first thought when you wake up in the morning? It was pretty much bodhicitta. He gave a couple of answers, but it pretty much comes back to bodhicitta. You wake up and it's bodhicitta. You know, that's how you start your day. Well, when that bodhicitta, this mind of enlightenment, or spirit of enlightenment, when this arises spontaneously, effortlessly, in a completely uncontrived way, then you're a bodhisattva and you've entered the path. Right? Which means now you have a trajectory. You're actually on your way someplace. You're not just cultivating some virtue here and a cultivating virtue there, which gives it fruit, and then it's gone. Right? But now one can ask this question, and this is a classic question, so it's been passed on for centuries. That's why I'm passing it on again. And that is, once that sublime, really noble, benevolent, majestic motivation has arisen, and you've entered the Mahayana path, could you fall off? Could you lose the path? Could you get derailed and then just be wandering around again, or no longer on that path anyway? Could it happen? And the classic answer is yes, it could. If you're on the initial stage of the Mahayana path of accumulation, it could happen that you'd lose it. Now, how could that happen? Well, if you witness something, especially of human behavior, that was so horrendous, like the Nazi Holocaust, or on occasions what the white Americans did to the Native Americans, just something so grotesque, or the Khmer Rouge, some of the atrocities they did, you gasp, the heart almost goes into seizure when you see the malevolence, the awfulness of what human beings are capable of. And one can imagine, and this is classic teachings, one can imagine a person who has indeed become a bodhisattva, but then witness something so unexpected and so profoundly evil that the bodhisattva might think, if times are like this, if the human race has become so degenerate that this can happen, and maybe even happen without being universally condemned, I don't think I can help you. It's almost like a doctor saying, you know, I'm not going to treat you anymore. I can't do anything for you. I'm really deeply sorry, but I can't do anything for you. And I'm going to go liberate myself. Okay? So how could one protect one's bodhicitta if one is really dedicated to the following Mahayana path? How could one protect one's bodhicitta so that no matter what you witnessed, you know, no matter what you witnessed, what you would witness would not give rise to dismay, despair, hopelessness, or just giving up on sentient beings, but actually arouse even deeper compassion. more like throwing even more fuel on the blaze of your bodhicitta. How could you turn the corner so that no matter what you witnessed from now until you're a Buddha, nothing can turn you away from the path? And that's what I called, and this is a traditional question, and I'm calling it sealing the path. You're on the path, now there's no backup. You're not going to inadvertently get on an off-ramp and then they just be wandering around again. And the classic Buddhist answer here from the Mahayana tradition is, if you seal your bodhicitta, if you reinforce it, empower it, protect it, any of those words would do, with insight, with wisdom, that will do it. That will do it. So wisdom protects compassion so that it doesn't reverse. Okay? And then if we say, okay, what kind of wisdom? What kind of wisdom would do that? And then the answer there from the classic teachings in the text called the Abhisamayalankara is gaining very deep, profound, experiential insight into the four applications of mindfulness. Okay? For which the three salient characteristics you're very familiar with, impermanence, the nature of dukkha, and the nature of non-self. The nature of non-self. And my strong intuition suggests to me that if one has gained a profound insight into the absence of an autonomous self of any group, any individual, any group, you know, and there have been some pretty horrendous groups in history. But if one really realizes these are not independent agents, it comes right back to Massimo's question, you know. If we recognize these are not just intrinsically evil people, these are people, as in the fascists in Italy, some of the horrendous things we've seen in America time and time again. You know, there's just plenty. We can spread this around all over humanity. We don't just need to pick on the Nazis, which are, you know, an easy target, but just all over the place. But none of these people, the most malevolent people, the people who'd use Native Americans for target practice, that happened. Or the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And I'm speaking as an American. Those were American slogans. The only Indian is a dead Indian. What's worse than that? I mean, it's so utterly, to say savage would be too much flattery. But even a person who has that attitude is not intrinsically evil. This person, too, is simply like a critically ill patient, and recognizing that, then the response is even deeper compassion. So that's what seals it. That's what seals it. And if it's sealed, then when you achieve that second level, you've now ventured further along this Mahayana path of accumulation, and you've empowered, protected, reinforced your compassion with insight, then it said your bodhicitta at that second level is now said to be gold-like bodhicitta. Gold-like bodhicitta. And it's called that because, at least in traditional alchemy or metallurgy in India, classical India, you can do all kinds of things with gold. You can melt it, you can hammer it, you can shape it in all kinds of things. The only thing you can't do with gold is to turn it into something that's not gold. Wood you can turn into ash, you can transform many, many things, but gold, it's just gold. You know? And so no matter what happens, that bodhicitta remains bodhicitta. And that means from then on, as soon as you've achieved that second stage of this Mahayana path of accumulation, then you're going in one direction only, and that is every lifetime. That bodhicitta is always going to be there. It'll always be moving you ahead in one line. And so Shantideva, a great bodhisattva in the 8th century, said, you know, if you view that, then you really shouldn't be daunted. I think he's speaking to himself and then anybody who reads his book. He said, you know, if you have that level of bodhicitta, then don't be daunted if the path to enlightenment takes many, many lifetimes or even eons. Don't be daunted by that. Don't be troubled by that. Because every single lifetime will be meaningful. Every single one will be going deeper into your own experience and or really sharing your goodness with the world. But it's a path. And that is, you're now on a trajectory and you're not simply wandering around. So one way or another, until one has achieved the path, whether it's this path of stream entry, which is quite exalted, or the Mahayana path of accumulation, second stage. To my mind, to say that's a very significant achievement would be a cosmic understatement. But to bring about such an inner revolution, an inner transformation, that one is not only for the rest of this lifetime, but for all possible future lifetimes, whether there are many or there are few, that every lifetime is on the path, that strikes me as immensely significant. And it's a major reason why I've been focusing my own practice on this trajectory of shamatha, vipassana, and dzogchen, and why I teach it so commonly. Because without having a profoundly sane mind, really a profoundly sane mind, one that's stable and clear, it's hard to imagine anything being irreversible. if you're bringing something of a kind of neurotic, flaky, imbalanced mind, how could that mind, whether practiced applying to Zen or Vajrayana or Dzogchen or Mahamudra or Vipassana, how could a mind that is so flaky be irreversible in anything? It can't hold anything irreversibly because it's just so prone to instability and dullness. So this is why I think the Buddha said, Shila Samadhi Prajna, establish a wholesome ethical way of life, because without that we have nothing, and then become exceptionally sane, and then do what's really meaningful. And there's the core structure of the Buddhist teachings. Okay? So, voilà, so that brings us to 6 o'clock.